Welcome to Air Crew Interview. I'm Mike Young, your host, and today's podcast is with Caroline Page. Caroline was a navigator in the RAF flying the F4 Phantom, Wessex and Merlin. In this episode, she talks about flying all the types and why she went from fast jets to helicopters. She also includes some great stories as well as a personal side. We also have two new features on our website. First is a newsletter that when you sign up, it gives you updates and news. The second is our Patreon page. So if you like what we do here, you could become one of our patrons by subscribing monthly, which there are three different levels. The costs go directly back into the channel and cover transport, accommodation, donations to museums for the backdrops. So please check out our website for all the features, and we hope to see you soon at www.aircrewinterview.tv. Thank you and enjoy. So Caroline, how did you become interested in aviation?
Oh, it all goes back to my youth. As a youngster, my father was in the army. He was a sergeant in the artillery. We moved around a lot, and we were in Malaya at the time. And quite close to our house used to be a landing strip, and helicopters used to come in. Scout, Belvedere, Whirlwind, those kind of things. And I used to watch them as a school kid and be fascinated by them. And then when he left the army, when he retired, we moved to Cheshire, the Wirral, and I went to school there, and I discovered the air cadets, and this thing about flying had stuck with me, and the air cadets sounded like a really good thing to do, so I joined the air cadets, and it was fantastic fun. It was to do with aeroplanes. I learned a lot about aeroplanes, and I actually got to go flying. And by the time I was 15, I applied for my gliding scholarship and was successful. So I went and did a gliding course, and going solo in a glider was just absolutely fantastic. And that led on to a wish to fly, become a pilot. And so when I got to 17, I applied for a flying scholarship, and I won that as well. So I ended up getting a private pilot's license. And that was the start of so by the time I was 17, I was well and truly into aviation, and I had this ambition then to make it a career. So whilst all my friends, I couldn't drive, didn't have a driving license, but while all my friends were bragging in sixth form that they all had driving licenses and things, wow, I've got a pilot's license.
What was your first flying experience?
If we discount flying out to Malaya in the back of a Britannia, I think it was, my first real flying experience was as an air cadet, air experience flying in Chipmunks.
So what year did you join the RAF?
I joined the Air Force in January 1980. I joined from Liverpool, from the Careers Information Office there. As I mentioned, I'd already had a flying scholarship, and it was the next step really to go flying. I wanted to be a pilot, and the only option I had that gave me that opportunity in terms of finance, because I couldn't afford to pay for my own licenses and things, if I wanted to go into the commercial world, then it was going to cost a fortune, and we didn't have any money. So I looked at military options. I looked at the Navy, and they said, yeah, great, you can come and fly helicopters, but you also have to work with boats. And the Army said, yeah, you can come and fly helicopters, but first of all, you have to work with tanks or whatever. And the Air Force said, yeah, you can come and fly, and you can fly aeroplanes. So that sounded the best option for me. So that's why I joined the Air Force. I joined in 1980.
Did you have a specific type and role you wanted?
Yes, as a pilot I wanted to fly helicopters because that had been my fascination as a youngster. That was the attraction. I enjoyed flying fixed wing with my pilot's license, but I actually thought I was going to be flying helicopters when I joined the Air Force. Little did I know.
When did your training start and what did it entail?
My training started fairly shortly afterwards. I did Cranwell for officer training from January 83 to May 80. And fairly soon after that, I went up to Linton-on-Ouse to fly the Jet Provost Mark III. And it was a little bit of a a trial. I think it had been running a while, but they used to take people through chipmunks at Swinderby for flying selection, so people had military experience. But because I already had a pilot's license, I went straight onto Jet Provost, which was probably a little bit of a downfall for me, as we'll come on to shortly. So I started on the JP3 at Linton-on-Ouse in about June, July 1980. And by the time I got to the end of the year, they were advising me that I might want to consider a different career, which was a great shame. Yeah.
So can you tell us a bit about your Jet Provost experience?
Yeah, well, to start with, it wasn't very good. I loved flying the Jet Provost. It was a jet, and actually you go solo as a 19-year-old or whatever, to be up in a jet-powered aircraft on your own was fantastic. So I did get to go solo a few times. But then they decided that my learning wasn't keeping up with the pace that they wanted or expected. If there was more money available, then I could have probably cracked it, but there wasn't. And in those days, it was kind of a harsh world. It was, you're out of here, gone. A little bit different to today, where they do their best to try and keep you in and give you follow-up packages and things. So I was absolutely gutted that my career as a pilot was coming to an end, but they offered me navigator, and I hadn't considered navigator as an option, really, when I joined, so I had to think about that. But I was still wanting to be in a cockpit, and I thought if I ended up in a cockpit on as a navigator, that was going to be good for me. Not all chopped pilots, because I was chopped, not all chopped pilots could go navigator, because it was different selection tests, different criteria that you had to pass going through your officer and aircrew selection procedures. But fortunately, I ticked the right boxes, so I was offered navigator training, went off to Finningley, and I started Finningley in 81. Initially on the Dominie, then onto the Jet Provost, back to the Dominie, and then onto the Jet Provost again. And these Jet Provosts were JP5s, and that was a much nicer machine. It was far more powerful, had a much nicer, more glass cockpit. Not glass cockpit in terms of instrumentation, but more glass for you to look out. A little bit of a better view if you compare the two aircraft to each other. But it was the performance thing. It had a pressurised cockpit, and it was just a really lovely aeroplane. When I was at Finningley, the first part was on Dominies, and you sat at the back, two navigators just sat there facing a panel, very similar to Vulcan sort of thing. It was geared up around Vulcan. And this was my first clue that navigator training and pilot training were completely different. Pilot training, they wanted you to be fast jet people. You couldn't join and say, I want to be a helicopter person. You had to want to strive to fast jets. And this was an issue I had when I was going through training. Navigator seemed to be the other way around. They wanted you to be good at all of the upper air stuff and the Vulcan. And of course, the Vulcan went into a low-level role as well. But it wasn't in a cockpit, it was in a fuselage, and I didn't want to do that. As much as it was a great job, and I'm sure the guys and girls that go onto those aircraft types love it, but it wasn't just for me. I wanted to be in a cockpit. So then I went on to the JP5, and that was looking at visual nav. So it was all down at 250 feet, and it was at 240 to 300 knots. And that suited me down to the ground, but it was all kind of targets and timings and that kind of stuff, low-level navigation. And that was more where I wanted to be. Back onto the Dominie, do the radar phase, and the radar phase was fantastic fun. It's radar prediction, so you're down at low level again, 250 feet in a Dominie, using the radar to find your way around and to make sure you don't bump into hills and things like that. Then you got streamed, and I got streamed air defence, which was exactly what I wanted. So I went onto a JP and went back into air intercept role, more like an air combat thing in the JP, because of course it didn't have a radar. So on the Jet Provost then, we went and did air combat, one against one. We bounced our mates who were going and doing the strike or the mud moving package, the guys that were going to go to Buccaneers and GR1s. They would go off and fly a mission, and it was our job to intercept them and give them a hard time and get them behind timings and all that kind of stuff. So that was great fun for me. And that's where I wanted to be, air defense. That was it, in a cockpit. That's where I wanted to be. But it wasn't a given, so I still had to meet all the criteria for all phases of the course. And at the end of it, you all the staff get together with the posting officers, the squadron commanders, a whole group of people. They decide your future. And I was really scared that I wasn't going to get, because I wanted Phantom, because that was the only two-seat fighter around at the time. So I was scared I wasn't going to get that.
Here, Caroline talks about her time flying the F4 Phantom.
Well, at the end of the course, we all had to go to the bar, and each course has a different way of learning what aircraft you're going to go and fly. And for my course, it was decided that the aircraft that you're going to be posted to was at the bottom of a glass of beer. So you had to drink this beer, and when you got down to the bottom of it, there was the aircraft that you're going to go and fly. And I was the last person to go up there, and there was... we'd already been told there was a Canberra slot, and all the other places had gone, and one of my friends had gone Buccaneers, and another friend had gone off to Phantoms. And so I kind of resigned myself to the fact I was going to Canberra. Now, Canberra, lovely aeroplane, fantastic, and you know, if I went to Canberra's, I would have enjoyed flying Canberra's, and it had a really great role, but I wanted to go. The Phantoms aren't the defence. So I was a little bit sort of worried that I wasn't going to get where I wanted to go. So I drank the drink, and there it was, a Phantom at the bottom of the glass. And a big smile that would probably have been seen from space, really. So Phantom, here's one I prepared earlier. So I can show you around if you like. Right, so here we are in the backseat cockpit of the F4, X-ray Victor 490. It's at Newark. I'll just talk you around it very, very quickly. This is a F4M. I was mostly based on F4Ks, which was the FG1. So this is an M model. Very slightly different in that it's got an inertial navigation system on the right-hand side here, which would have been a fantastic bonus on QRA. So, what have we got then? Things that you can see at the moment up here are the, this is the TESS, the telescopic sighting system, which gives you a 10 times magnification because, as I mentioned earlier, you want to shoot something. If you've got an aircraft with missiles that go a long way and they're going to be radar guided, then it's pointless having to get really, really close to an enemy to use them. So you want to see as quickly as possible. Now, in the days of the Cold War, it was easy because anything that was heading east to west at high speeds during the time of war, unless it was squawking friendly, or unless it had been identified as friendly fighters coming back maybe, or whatever, by an air defence unit. If it was not one of ours, then it was going to get shot head on. So you would lose a sky flash for that. However, sometimes if you're not sure and you want to see what it is, the only way you can really do that, especially in those days, was visually. And so the first person to see has an advantage, has a little bit of an advantage. So this was brought in probably mid-80s, and it's a simple sighting system, was on a tank before it ended up on a Mach 2 aeroplane. And all it enabled me was to lock to a target with the radar. The pilot could maneuver a dot to put it into the bore sight of the aircraft, and then I could look through here and hopefully see what it was. And as soon as I could identify it as friendly or foe, then we could shoot. See if it's a foe. You know, you don't want to shoot if it's friendly. So that's what that is. Then on the top of here, this was chaff and flare. Chaff and flare system for protecting countermeasures, protecting ourselves. You could set up various profiles for how many flares you want to go out with, what sequencing, and all that. And then it was release. There's another button there. There's a button here. I would release the flares in the back. More often than that, only ever saw those in the Falklands. We didn't really carry them on QRA, really. And then we've got flight instruments, very basic flight instruments. So an altimeter, an attitude indicator, an airspeed, a Mach meter, and a heading reference system along the top. Very, very few cautions up here. So if there's a problem with the aircraft and it gives you a caution, most of them are in the front, but you get a few of the more important ones in the back here as well. And there's a master caution also as well. Eject. There's an eject light there, so if he wants me, he doesn't like my banter anymore and says, presses that button, then I have to eject, so that's quite bad. In the Phantom, there was no command eject system, so the standard procedure, especially at low level, was if there was no time to do anything, any kind of warning, the front seat just ejected. So you're sitting here and the front seat canopy comes up, the guy goes out, gets very windy, all of a sudden that's a good cue to be leaving the aeroplane yourself, so then you would eject. It's no command eject. Normally the standard was for the back seater to eject first, because obviously he's flying the aeroplane, so the back would go, and also that would get rid of the canopy out of the way, because if he went and I went at the same time, I would be hit by a canopy and that would be bad. So it's kind of SOP but coordinated if you needed to leave the aircraft at all. The main part of the aeroplane though, for me as navigator, apart from looking out, was the radar here system. So we can have a look at that in a short while. Down the left-hand side, we've got all the radar controls. Right-hand side, we've got screen. And that would normally come up and you would be able to see it, or it would be up here. And then I'd be trying to protect it from the sun, because it was very difficult to see the display in bright suns. And some guys made little devices to go on top to keep the sun off. But and then there's a controller here. So with that controller, I could do various functions with the radar. Fantastic radar. Pulse Doppler, as I said, look down, shoot down. Very, very good radar. In its day, there's radars around clearly now that surpass it, but then that's the digital age, so you would expect nothing less. The inertial navigation system down that side, and then down this side really is the communications, the TACAN, the HF radio, which again, HF radio was only fitted to the FDR2s, the mic model, not to the Ks. Which is a bit bizarre, because we were tended to do all the long range away from anybody. Sometimes, usually you had radio contact with somebody, but not all the time. So especially if you went low level, right out in the Iceland Faroes area, you wouldn't be able to speak to anybody. So it would have been nice to have an HF maybe. TACAN was good for beacons out to about 186 miles outside that, not much used. But you could also use it for an air-to-air mode, so you could get distance from a wingman or a tanker, more importantly, see how far away your tanker is and look at the fuel and go, yeah, we've got enough. And that's pretty much it, really. The ejection seat, never had to use it, thankfully. A couple of occasions where it came close, but not had to use it. You dialed your weight in, I can show you that shortly, and then you're attached to the ejection seat with a PEC, personal equipment connector, which had your G-suit, air supply, and your oxygen supply, and your intercom, and all that kind of stuff. Up here's the pins for the seat. There should be five up there. Hopefully, it's just a reminder, so that if you get airborne and you look around and there's a gap, then there's a pin in the seat. That's bad. That means the seat probably won't work if you need to use it. Canopy emergency jetson, and that's pretty much it. Got a clock, so got a clock.
So, could you tell us some of your roles on the F4?
Roles on the F4. By the time I got to the F4, it was purely used in the air defence role. It had been used for strike, ground attack, but it was purely air defence, which was great because that's what I wanted to do. I went to the F4 in 82, and I was posted to RAF Lucas and Travel 1 Squadron. And RAF Lucas, you'll always get F4 guys saying that the base that they went to was the best, because the Germany guys will say Germany was where it was at, the Wadisham guys would say Wadisham is where it's at, or Coningsby. But for me, it really was at Lucas, because for several reasons, one of which was the unrestricted airspace that was around you. You'd come off the runway and you'd be over the Scottish Highlands in one direction, or over the sea in the other direction, where you were totally unrestricted for doing supersonics and things like this. So you could exploit the whole role of the aircraft from low level up to high flying targets, really high flyers, supersonics, you could do the works. But also you had the benefit of QRA, Northern QRA was very active, certainly when I was fortunate enough to be on the aircraft. So the role up at Lucas was part of Northern QRA, so we had that commitment, and outside of that it was training. And of course the Cold War was on, so all of the training was designed around what you would do for real in your real role, which was air defence. And the air defence role is kind of sea shadow, simplified terms, sea shadow shoot. So you'd be launched to either go and find out what something was, so a radar station, the UK Air Defence ground environment would pick up something, they would scramble a fighter to go off and see what it was. And then once you identified it, then you would get instructions on what they wanted to do with it, whether they wanted it shot down, whether they wanted it shadowed to see what it was up to, whether they were just happy with knowing what it was, or whether they wanted you to shepherd it to an airfield, something where if they wanted it to land, because it violated airspace, etc. There's lots of reasons. So the main roles of the aircraft were therefore to get airborne, identify something, to shepherd it, to shadow it, to see what it was up to, which was largely what we did with QRA, but also to shoot it down. And so the aircraft was always live armed, and for QRA anyway. And fighters were quite unique in that fighters, you made all of the switches as though you were going to pull the trigger and a missile was going to come off or the gun was going to fire. You did everything all the way through training. So your end result in intercepting an aircraft, and whether you engaged it or shadowed it or whatever, was exactly what you would do for real in war. The only difference is when you squeeze the trigger, a rocket would come off or the gun would shoot. So our day-to-day training was to hone those skills. And of course, with the Cold War, the main purpose of the fighter was air defence, and it was a long-range air defence interceptor, really. So it stood outside on the outer caps, and it was the first layer of defence for the United Kingdom. Behind that you had Bloodhounds, and behind that you had Rapiers, missile defensive systems, and you also had shorter range fighters like the Hawk. So the Phantom was the long range first line of defence for the United Kingdom during the Cold War.
Could you tell us what it was like to first strap into an F4?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, really. You walk out to the aircraft and come up the ladder, and you're already thinking, wow, this is a long way up. So it's an impression of size, but you only have to look at the Phantom to love it and see. It's a fantastic looking aeroplane, so walking out to it is the first impression. It's kind of, wow, I'm going to go flying on one of these. This is awesome. And then when you strap in, it's quite a process strapping in. It's nice. The ground crew also see the aircraft off and make sure that the air crew are all strapped in. So there's a guy stood on the intake there. He's handing me straps because they're a little bit behind here. He hands the straps over. I strap myself in, we check the pins, and then I get on with the checks and things. So that is how you start. And then that's quite an amazing feeling. When you actually start up, go out onto the runway, and then the burners kick in, and you get this huge shove up the backside from the aeroplane, and it motors down that runway like a bat out of hell. It's kind of, wow, this is really cool. I'm loving this job. This is really great.
So what squadrons were you based with?
Actually, when I was on the Phantom, I was fortunate enough to stay on the same squadron. I did two and a bit tours on the same squadron, so it was all on 111 squadron up at Lucas. I deployed down to the Falklands with as part of 23 squadron when that was still there, and then it became 1435 flight, so I did detachments with 1435 flight. So Phantom-wise, mainly it was the 111 squadron, 111 fighter squadron, which was a squadron with a fantastic heritage, and it was 7 years I did on the squadron. Just over 1500 hours on the aircraft up there in that time, and it was just, that was my only squadron, really.
Caroline tells a great story about intercepting Russian bears.
Intercept a bear? Yeah, thousands of them. But I was really fortunate. I know some guys went through their careers and never, ever, ever saw one. I was always in the right place at the right time. I ended up with a tally of 34 bears and two badgers. And during the mid to late 80s, it just kind of went wild with the Soviets sending their aircraft across. And on some occasions, on one trip I remember, we got four aircraft in the one trip. So the bear was fantastic, because that's what it was all about for us. That was seeing the face of our enemy as such, you know, the red star on the side of the aeroplane. That's what it was all about. So doing QRA was a fantastic thing to do, because you felt like you were actually were protecting your country and you were doing a vital role. And of course the excitement of QRA was that you could get launched any time of the day, any time of the year. So 2 o'clock in the morning, the hooter goes, we had two aircraft ready to go immediately on RS-10, readiness state 10, and a third one that would come up in an hour, which we occasionally had to use. We had to use that. So what would normally happen is the hooter would go, you'd get scramble instructions, you'd run out to the aeroplane, both aircraft would start in case one had problems, but we'd only send one. The UK only ever sent one fighter, so you go up on your own in the middle of the night, completely unsupported, other than speaking to a radar station, a ground radar station, and your mate in the aircraft, that was the only support you had. So it could be quite lonely and dark, and especially in an FG-1, because the FG-1s were based up at Lucas, 111 and 43. We didn't have an INAS, so we relied on the radar. The radar was good for spotting land, but quite often a QRA mission would take you way outside of the range of seeing land on radar, way outside the range of TACANs and things like that. So it's kind of guesswork as to where you were sometimes. So we would get launched, QRA-1 would go first, completely unsupported, get up there as quick as possible, find out what it was, which was often a challenge, and then shadow it, waiting for instructions. And then the tanker would come up, and if the tanker had time, if there was time for QRA to come up with the tanker, they would launch the second aircraft, Q2. Q1 would go back, turn around and get ready to go again, and then Q2 would stay up there for the longer mission. But it varied. Sometimes Q1 was just sufficient and that would stay up there until the tanker came up, or sometimes you would get up there and there was nothing around, so it's a false alarm and come home. So to get 34 bears of all sorts of different types of things in the darkness, at low level, at high level, as pairs, as four ships, it was brilliant.
Do you have one memorable intercept?
One memorable intercept? I suppose it was, we launched and found a couple of bears in the Iceland Faroes Gap, and they were heading off down towards Cuba, and we were instructed to follow them. So we followed them all the way off the coast of Ireland, the west coast of Ireland, which is a long, long, long way. We were up nearly all day. We saw a couple of tankers come up, Victors predominantly, come up. We took their fuel, they ate their sandwiches and went home, and we were still there. So long sortie, but it was good. But they were all memorable, especially at the time, because there was if the aircraft didn't get airborne within the 10 minutes allocated, questions were asked in the House of Parliament, because that was a national commitment. You had to have a fighter in the air within 10 minutes. Now that's a maximum. Often you would do it in way less than that, but it depended. For instance, if you were on the furthest runway, you had a mile and a half to taxi. So, you know, if you're getting launched at 2 o'clock in the morning, by the time you've got your kit on, started the aircraft up, taxied a mile and a half, and got airborne, that's cutting into your 10 minutes. But generally, guys did it a lot quicker than 10.
Caroline talks about changing over to the Wessex.
end of 89, I was posted to Chivenet, to the tactical weapons unit, as the nav instructor on 63 Squadron, flying the Hawk, T Mark 1A. The tactical weapons unit was responsible for taking pilots and navigators and stepping them up a gear from the training system into more operational stuff, dropping bombs, fighting the aircraft, actually fighting the aircraft as opposed to flying it or operating it. Before they went off to operational conversion units. So I ended up down there on 63 Squadron. Fantastic job, loads of fun. Hawk, brilliant aeroplane. But by the time I came to the end of that tour, which was end of 92, and go back to the F4, the F4 had gone out of service. It was sadly, really sadly, just being scrapped left, right and centre, and that was just so sad. Fantastic aeroplane. So I had to look at a change, and going back to my early days of what attracted me to flying and into the Air Force in the first place was helicopters. So and fortuitously, at the time, the Air Force was looking for fast jet navigators to go to helicopters. Post Gulf War I, some of the GR1 squadrons were folding. So there was GR1 navigators, F4 navigators. So it was about, I think, probably just under a dozen of us were sought to go and take our experience of two-person cockpit ops into the helicopter world. Because the helicopter world had always flown with somebody in the cockpit, but quite often it wasn't a dedicated pilot navigator like how we used to fly in the military. And they liked that option because helicopters were getting more and more and more involved with stuff behind or very close to enemy lines, and they wanted to have that tactical awareness and just bring it on another gear. They were already doing a lot of good stuff because of Northern Ireland. They were doing a lot of good stuff, but they just wanted to bring that experience in from fast jets. So they were asking for volunteers, and that gave me an opportunity to say, yeah, do you know what? I've had a brilliant time in air defence, but now I want to go and have a look at helicopters. And so I did. So I had to go through the whole training system again. Shawbury, spent a long time at Shawbury flying the Gazelle and the Wessex, which is what I'm sat in now, the mighty Wessex, a fantastic aeroplane. And at the end of Shawbury, I was posted to the Wessex on 60 Squadron down at Bempsham. And that was my introduction to helicopters. Now, the thing about helicopters is obviously they're an awful lot slower than what I was used to. I'd had a little bit of a work down. I'd come down from fast jets a la Phantom, supersonic capable, big muscle jet to the Hawk, brilliant little agile fighter that it is, but it was a training aeroplane. It had a war role, it had a very good war role, which we practiced. But the advantage with the Hawk, what the Hawk gave me was the opportunity to do visual nav at low level, running in for targets and things, because we didn't really do that in the Phantom. So it gave me a little bit of help there. But going into a helicopter, and now especially this one, the Wessex, where we were cruising around at 90 knots now instead of 420 or 540, is a bit of a slowdown. And all the navigation was visual navigation, so map, window, and a stopwatch, which is around here somewhere. But not only did the speed come down, the height came down as well, because in those days, as a helicopter, for training, the defence of a helicopter is not to be seen in the first place. If it gets seen, it's quite vulnerable, but I can talk about that a little bit later on. So if you're not seen in the first place, you can sneak around, nobody knows you're there, get the job done brilliantly. So it's all about low level, and our normal transit height, or en route height, I should say, was 50 feet. So although you're doing 90 knots, you're now down at 50 feet. And actually, when you get as you get closer and closer to the enemy, you've got a whole load of troops in the back. So we're carrying 12 to squeeze in 16, perhaps, at a squeeze, depending on what the troops are carrying. But normally about 12 guys. And you're trying to get them close to the enemy so that they can do their mission. So we used to do something called concealed approach and departure, which is CAD. CADs. And that means that as you get closer to the enemy, you're using the ground, you're using all the obstacles around you, you're using trees. So you're down in amongst the trees and you're flying around below treetop height, trading off speed for height, for noise, and lots of considerations so that you can get the soldiers as close to their enemy as possible without them being seen. So that was the big difference between helicopters and Phantoms. One of the other big advantages for me was, I don't know if you can see in shot, but it's dual control. Everything is dual about this aircraft. So as a navigator, this is my place in the left-hand seat. So I then became a navigator, kind of not officially a co-pilot. I wasn't allowed to be a co-pilot because I'd not been through pilot training as such. I had a little go at it, clearly. But I was still expected to be able to fly the aeroplane because if something happens, we're at risk of being shot at in the role that we did. And if something happens to the guy in the right-hand seat and you've got 12 people in the back, more in the Merlin than we'll come on to later, it's a bit silly if I'm just sat here going, well, I don't know how to fly it. So I did, so I flew it. And I got loads of hands on this aircraft. And in fact, on my limited combat ready check, I flew with a squadron commander. We flew for 10 hours. And the thing about the Wessex is you hunch forward, and quite a lot of helicopters, as a pilot, you end up hunching forward on the controls, and you end up with a bad back, especially if you're flying for a long time, helicopter back and knees for the crewman. So, 10-hour mission, he wanted to give me a go. So he didn't know me really well. It's the first time he'd flown with me. So he said, all right, I'll get it up to that height. And when we're traveling between the two, you can fly. So great. So there I was, flying the aircraft. And then after a while, he said, right, you can have a go at the approach, but I'll take over the landing. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, I ended up doing the whole lot, flying the aircraft, picking the troops up, flying off to their drop point, putting the aircraft down the ground, troops get out, flying off to a refueling site, taking on fuel. I did everything. And at the end of the sortie, the squadron commander turned around to me and said, combat ready nav or LCR pilot. So I thought he was joking. I bet he did try to get me a pilot course, but unfortunately I was too old. There was an age thing going on there. So I was prevented from... what I joined it would have been fantastic because it would have been a circuitous route around getting what I wanted to do when I joined the Air Force in the first place, which was to fly helicopters, and to do that would have been brilliant. But I had a fantastic time on air defence in the meantime with the Phantom. So I ended up on this lovely old girl, the Wessex. Retired from service in late 90s, it retired from service. So I was on Wessex at 60 Squadron for 93, I'm getting all my dates mixed up, see. 93, I ended up on the Wessex with 60 until 97. And I got just under 800 hours on this, and a lot of it, it depends on who you flew with. So if you, most guys would let you fly it, some guys went, no, it's mine, and they wouldn't let you fly the aircraft, but generally I got to fly it. Easy aeroplane to fly. It was used as a trainer at Shawbury, so easy aeroplane to fly. I could fly it. Operating it, obviously, there's a difference between being able to fly something and being able to operate it. So, when you're doing the operational side of the job, then a lot more skills. And also, if things go wrong, yeah, I can fly it, but if we start getting engine fails and things going wrong with the rotors, then I'd like somebody who's got a bit more time and qualifications flying aircraft to sort that out for me. Wessex.
Caroline chats about the Merlin.
So you then moved on to the Merlin. How did this become about, and what were your roles?
Okay, Merlin, I have a habit of going onto aeroplanes and they end up out of service. So the Wessex was coming to the end of its life in the late 90s. And so my squadron was running down again. And there was a new kid on the block, a Merlin, but it wasn't in service at that point. But they wanted air crew to go and help onto an organisation called Ruitu. Ruitu had only just formed, Ruitu Wing Operational Evaluation and Training Unit. And this was trials flight, basically, looking after all the new equipment coming onto aircraft and making sure that what we had did the job. Everything from what you wore as flying clothing through to what the aircraft used for countermeasures and how it was operated and all the tactics and all that kind of stuff. And since I got onto helicopters, they respected my fast jet experience and they wanted me to teach them tactics and things. So I had to qualify on helicopters to do that. So I went off and did a helicopter tactics course, which was a whole load of fun with Chinooks and Wessex. These days, it now includes Army Air Corps and Navy aircraft crews and types as well. And as part of this course, you learn how to fly the aircraft tactically, but also to teach tactics. And your tactics include how to avoid ground-based air defense units and how to avoid fighters. So we ended up doing fights against F3s and things like that. So now I was on the receiving end, now as a target, as opposed to being the hunter, which was a bit of a turnaround. As the Wessex came to the end of its service, they were looking for somebody to go onto this unit to help introduce the Merlin into service. This was an Augusta Westland joint project. And so I was really fortunate to be the first person, A, to be posted onto this unit, because it was only forming as I joined it. It moved to me at Benson, so the organisation formed at Benson. I was already there, so they came up to me, renamed, it used to be Tactics and Trials Flight, renamed, rebadged, and I became the Merlin SME. And I was joined by a pilot, Tony, and eventually a crewman, Dave. And between the three of us, we were responsible for liaising with Westlands, because the aircraft hadn't been built, it was still being built. So liaising with Westlands and seeing what equipment they were going to fit to it and how, where that equipment was going to go and how it was going to be used and if it was practical to be used in that way, all this kind of stuff. So I was on the Merlin actually for a couple of years before it actually came into service. And it was quite an honour to be involved in it right at the very, very start. The Merlin has only just left service, and we'll talk about that shortly. It's only just left service. It's gone to the Navy now. But I was with that aircraft from it before it actually came into service as a baby, all the way through to it growing up, and then going off to join the Navy. My first role on the Merlin was on the operational evaluation unit, bringing the aircraft into service. And that was from 97 through to end of 98. At the end of 98 into 99, there was a few personal things going on, so I took it aside. And I rejoined Merlin in 2000, and I joined 28 Squadron. 28 Squadron was the first unit to form with the Merlin, and then it was the only unit that had the Merlin Mark III, which is the Air Force version. The Navy were flying anti-submarine version already. So I joined the squadron in 2000, and we didn't have the aircraft then. The aircraft didn't arrive for about another year, so I helped set the squadron up and get it ready for its reformation ceremony, because it had come back from Hong Kong. The squadron was out in the Far East for pretty much most of its history. And when we got the aircraft, I was then on the first operational conversion flight. So there was about 10 of us, I think, who were the first crews to go on the Mighty Merlin. So by the time I finished that was 2002. And we were working the aircraft up. Now the Merlin was a fantastic aeroplane for combat recovery, for joint personnel recovery, JPRCR as we call it. So we started up working the squadron into that role. So it was going to go out and recover downed aircrew, fast jet guys that were brought down behind enemy lines. The Merlin was fantastic for it. It was long range, had very long legs, very fast, had loads of good nav systems on it, had a forward-looking infrared turret on it. It had air-to-air refueling capability, all sorts of things that made it a perfect long-range aircraft. unfortunately, the Merlin was stumped by the fact that war changed. War changed completely. We went from the Cold War, which is where the aircraft was designed, into fighting terrorism and counterinsurgency and all that kind of stuff, which we'd been doing with the Wessex before in Northern Ireland, but this was obviously following 9/11. Everybody's lives changed forever, and the role of the Merlin and indeed all of the UK forces' role changed. So we had to get out of a mindset of fighting the Warsaw Pact kind of fight and get into a different world, and that's what the Merlin was born into. So we worked up with the JPR. We had RAF regiment guys attached to the squadron, and they were the ground extraction force, and we did a lot of training for that, but then it was removed because it's a 24-seat troop helicopter and you don't want it sat on standby doing an equivalent of a QRA type thing, sat on standby all day not being moved when we haven't got enough helicopters ready for moving troops. So that was all kind of folded overnight, and it went back to being doing the same role as all battlefield helicopters were doing. Same as the Chinook, same as the Puma, same as the Wessex.
Caroline gives us a more personal side.
So how did I get to fly Phantoms as a female? That's a very, very long story. Very, very long story. Because clearly in the 80s, girls weren't allowed to fly fast jets. But I'm a transgender woman. So when I joined the Air Force, they weren't aware of this. It was something I was aware of from around the age of 4. It was a struggle that I had. And actually, flying is what saved my life, because having a focus, as a youngster, I was having all sorts of issues. But the world wasn't ready to accept those. So I had to hide them, and so I hid them from the Air Force. But around when I started on the Merlin, just before, around 98, I was thinking I need to sort my own life out. So I approached the Air Force and told them that I was transgender and I was going to transition gender. And I was expecting to be thrown out because that was the way the world was then. But fortunately, they liked me enough to keep me in. And so I then served for another 16 years as myself. I was able to live and work as myself. So throughout my whole career on the Merlin, I was Caroline Page. But when I was flying on the Phantom, people knew me as a different name. The Air Force never had an issue with that. People I worked with never had an issue with that. And the job that I did on the Merlin in particular, in keeping people safe in Iraq and Afghanistan, went down very well. I won several awards for the work that I was doing out there, which helped people to respect me as a person. It wasn't anything to do with my past, it was just me doing the job. And so that's how I came to be Caroline Page, and with a background flying the Phantom.
If this is even possible to pin down, what's your most memorable RAF career moment?
My most memorable RAF career moment? There's so many of them, it's trying to pick one. I mean, actually going fast jets from nav training was brilliant, because I'd been, I felt really down not having been able to progress through pilot training. So to get a fast jet posting, that was a massive highlight for sure. Flying the Wessex and flying the Merlin as well, actually hands-on flying, gave me a big smile. So those two things were big factors. But I'd say the most enjoyable thing about my career flying was that, apart from 18 months, it was all flying. I flew. I was in the Air Force for 35 years, and there was an 18-month gap where I went off to sort myself out. I was still working in the Air Force, where I was on a ground tour at a headquarters. Outside that 18 months, all of my Air Force career was flying, involved with flying. So I got over 5,000 hours, and I flew on 18 different operations in that time. So the fact that I stayed flying throughout the whole career, that is probably the biggest.
Do you ever go to air shows?
Yeah, I do. I haven't been to one for a couple of years. The last one I was at was Waddington. Unfortunately, Waddington one has been off the program for a short while. And it's probably not coming back, from what I understand. But I enjoy going to air shows, yeah.
Do you have a favorite tipple?
Yeah, I have lots of favorite tipples. wine always wins. It doesn't matter whether it's white, red, or rosé, or but it's got bubbles in it or not. Wine always wins.
Do you have any hobbies?
I have a couple of hobbies. I'm writing books, but I don't have a book to show you at the moment. It's still in the process of being written. And I'm just getting into photography, so I kind of quite like doing that. I spend a lot of time doing voluntary work at the moment. But I've also just, yesterday, I was accepted for a job that I've been wanting to do for quite some time now, because when I left the Air Force, I was still a tactics instructor, and I was, in my last 2 years of service, I was teaching European crews tactics, and I've just been offered a job starting on the end of this month, really. Going back to doing that, teaching European helicopter crews tactics and electronic warfare. So that's almost like a hobby, but I'm being paid for it. Also, I'm involved with Black Mike. Black Mike is the F4 that is still up at Lucas. It was a Treble 1 Squadron Phantom, an FG1 K model. Towards the end of Treble 1's Phantom era, we painted one of the aircraft, 582, gloss black. And if anybody's not seen it yet, it's fantastic airplane. It's a beautiful airplane to see. Gloss black F4, fantastic. And that was in honor of the Black Arrows, because before the Red Arrows actually existed, squadrons had their own aerobatics teams, and there was a Black Arrows, there was a Green Arrows, and there was all sorts of things. Each squadron had its own. And the squadron colours were black and gold. So we painted the aircraft in those colours in honour of the Black Arrows. And that aircraft survived, and it was up at Lucas, and it was taken on by 228, the ACU, and it was rolled out at air shows and things. It doesn't fly anymore now, unfortunately, but it's got everything in it, all engines and everything, ready to go. And it's just been bought to try and save it, because once Lucas closed, then there was a fear that it was going to end up on the scrap heap like all the others. So it's just been bought, and there's a group. It's been provided by GJD, but there's the British Phantom F4 Phantom Aviation Group is looking after renovation projects for the Phantom, like 490 that we saw outside Black Mike, and the aim is to hopefully get Black Mike down to Bruntingthorpe and give her a full renovation program. So I'm helping with that, and we're hoping to raise funds to be able to get that aeroplane back up in all its glory. It won't probably get airborne with today's rules and regulations, but it will still be able to hopefully one day run its engines again and do practice scrambles without the scramble bit.
And finally, do you ever get sick of talking about aviation?
Yeah, so anyway, what do you want to know? Do I ever get sick of talking? No, I don't think anybody that's involved with aviation ever does.
Well, thanks very much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and got an insight into what it's like to be a navigator on both fast jets and helicopters. So again, if you like what we do, please head over to our website and become a patron at www.aircrewinterview.tv. Thank you.